Welcome to Healing with Worth, a podcast dedicated to healthy recovery and instilling hope in the wake of betrayal trauma. We are women who have experienced this intimately and want to offer hope to other women. While we may interview professionals on the show, the content should not be taken as therapeutic advice and is not meant to replace therapeutic healing. If you would like to join one of our free online Worth groups to help with your betrayal trauma, you may find us at healingwithworth.org. Welcome to Healing with Worth. We are your hosts, Janine and Naomi, and today we have a special guest with us, Carmel Parker White. Carmel has a doctorate in lifespan human development from Kansas State University. She has a master's and bachelor's degrees from Brigham Young University. She has been in higher education for over 20 years and is currently working at the Correlation Research Division at LDS Church Headquarters. She has authored and co-authored 25 peer-reviewed articles. She currently lives in Sandy, Utah, and she is also the co-author of Love and Betrayal, Stories of Hope to Help You Heal from Your Husband's Pornography Addiction. So we are excited to have Carmel here to talk with us a little bit today about her journey and what her experience was, and talking a little bit about the topic of shame as well, since this is such a big topic in this world. Carmel, thank you so much for coming and for talking with us and being here with us today. We really appreciate your time.
I'm happy to be here.
So why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about your journey in writing the book? This book happened to come out about the same time that my experience started to unveil before my eyes. And it was one of the first books I actually read to kind of get validated really in my experience with betrayal. Yeah. And so I really appreciated hearing the different stories and the interviews that you had in this book. And it really helped me to know that while each experience is very different, there are some underlying similarities.
Right, exactly.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Okay, Janine, and I'm glad that it was helpful for you. So I had been living with pornography in my marriage for many years. There reached a point where I was kind of at a crossing point where, do I stay in this relationship? Do I leave this relationship? And as I worked with my ecclesiastical leader, the bishop of my ward, it really helped me to hear his perspective. He had come from a situation where his sister, who wasn't a member of the LDS Church, but she had had an alcohol addiction. And the fact that he understood, he'd taken the time and invested the energy into learn about addictions. The fact that he understood an addiction really helped me to feel that, first of all, that he knew what was going on and he could appreciate what I was living with, and that his guidance was going to be invaluable for me. At that point, when my marriage ended, he encouraged me to write a book about pornography addiction and what it does to marriages. And when I started to think about writing the book, what was important to me is what you said, Janine, early on, is that no two women's experiences are going to be exactly alike. Everybody has their own path and their own journey. Sometimes it's a journey that comes after just a few months of marriage. Sometimes it's a journey that comes after decades of marriage. Sometimes it comes to people who are kind of more ultra conservative in how they live their religion, and other times people may be a little bit more laid back, and sometimes different personalities. So what I saw was just how different people were in handling this problem and knowing what to do as you were walking down that journey, and that it could be your own path. It didn't have to be my sister's path or my mother's path. It was my own path. And the things that I felt that I experienced were my own. You're right, there's similarities. And one of the similarities is shame. We each have our own path that we're going to go through as we're living with this in our marriage.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm an inspiring author myself, so you're inspiring me to write more about it, because I do think that it's a topic that is shameful to talk about. We are not comfortable talking about this in our congregations, in our social circles.
Right, exactly.
The isolation really can keep us stuck in the shame that we're dealing with.
Right. And there's shame at so many different levels. So there's the shame that kind of radiates from your spouse's own shame about the problem, which I believe that a pornography addiction is a shame-driven addiction, like many addictions are. But there's also the shame that comes as somebody that's living with that. So, you know, for women that are first having exposure to this, they feel shame about, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. You know, if I was a good enough woman, this wouldn't be an issue. Or if I was pretty enough, this wouldn't be an issue. Or if I was more sexy, this wouldn't be an issue. For me, it took me a couple years to figure out I could have been a supermodel, and the pornography addiction was totally different from me. This was him. I think that's a tricky road for women to finally be able to say, this isn't related to me per se. This is his addiction, and I'm on the journey with him. But that's, you know, it's not dependent upon me. And one of the things that I always kind of found myself saying was that this addiction existed before we were married and before he knew me. And that always made me feel a little bit better, like, okay, this isn't my fault. I had that, you know, in my own story, but I think in some women's stories, they're not going to have that, that the addiction may have started when they're married, but women still need to realize this is not their fault, that this is something that's going on with him and his behaviors.
Yeah, I think that's really important for women to understand. And thankfully, I sought the help right away that allowed me to see that this has nothing to do with you, Janine. Yeah. This is all about him and his inability to cope with his own life and emotions. That was very, very helpful. What I've noticed, at least for myself, like in my recovery circle, there's not shame, but, you know, if I'm going to a dinner party, maybe with my husband, and we start having conversations about my own life, it's like there is this resistance to share. Oh, well, I'm doing a podcast and I'm volunteering and helping out with a retreat and all these other pieces that connect myself to being someone who's been betrayed and someone who has a husband who's has had a secret life. Depending on what social circumstances I'm in, there is this kind of shame that still kind of creeps up in my life. And it's interesting to see how I'm kind of navigating through that and how I can navigate through that and still be authentic and still, you know, be truthful and still be able to share a part of my life. And I'm still working through all that.
Yeah. And I think you will continue to work through all that for the remainder of your development and of your lifespan. I think it becomes different as our life circumstances change, but there's always that tension of how do I share what was going on and it not become the focus or people react in a way that makes me feel more shamed. I think the other reason that this book was important to me is for most of my adult life, I've lived away from my family of origin, my parents and siblings, and away from kind of the headquarters of the LDS Church. And I've lived, you know, in other states. I found the resources available in other locations were very sparse. And the people that were willing to talk about this were even more sparse, that it just wasn't something that came up in congregations. And it wasn't something that people necessarily felt comfortable talking about. One of the women we interviewed for the book, that I just loved her perspective. She said, people can talk about in Sunday school class how they're dealing with cancer and how they're living with this treatment and this is scary to them and, you know, really go into detail and kind of elicit the whole class support and respect. And she said, I can't do that with pornography. I can't say, yes, my challenges right now, I feel, are likened to dealing with cancer, but I can't share that with anyone. And nobody really knows what's going on in my life and how I'm handling it. And I think that just perpetuates the shame in the whole experience, feeling like, okay, there's no real place that I can be open and honest about that. One thing I didn't write about in the book related to shame that I actually found out after publishing the book, and I think people will be able to relate to this if they have children, is when and if do children need to know? Because it is such a shameful thing. I remember when my oldest daughter found out what the problem was, and she was a young adult, and she said, I would have wished he was gay than this. I would have wished that. And, you know, not that being gay is wrong, but in her mind, this was a very shameful thing because she had been raised in a culture where it was so full of shame that she wished for something else to be the explanation. And I think as women go along in their lives, they have to kind of figure out, what am I going to tell my children so that they don't have these shame feelings? How am I going to tell them so that there's not that shame? Because that's going to be, you know, something that you're going to have to deal with. At what point do you let your children know that this is what you've lived with? I think that's a really tricky thing for us to figure out, to how to tell our children and at what age is it appropriate and how to do it without the shame associated with it.
It is such a tricky thing. I remember there was shame I was experienced with my own parents divorcing. You know, that at the time was very, it felt very like a mark, so yeah, to speak, had been put on me. But I think with the prevalence of pornography these days, we have to start empowering our children with tools to be able to deal with,
right,
with their own shame,
yeah,
around this.
Yeah.
It's easier to talk about same gender type issues than it is pornography, mm-hmm, in a marriage. Mm-hmm. But with the prevalence of it, I think we just need to start talking more about it and being more open about it. It's a tricky thing to navigate for sure.
And I'm kind of out of the trenches right now because I've been divorced and separated and divorced for almost 13 years now. But I have found when I've been in places where I know that it's going on, I will often say to the ecclesiastical leader, the bishop, that if there's any woman that would like to talk about this, I'm happy to talk with her and keep it private and feel free to share my book with them. But it's been very interesting. Over all of those years, I've only had one woman reach out to me. And this was a woman that I already knew very well. That was, I think, the only reason she felt she could get over her shame over telling somebody was that she knew me well and she knew how much I respected and loved her. But I think, you know, even somebody that is pretty out there with it, not everybody is rushing in to say, I need your help, I need your support. I just think there's a huge problem, as you've already said, with shame and getting over that shame. And why is that important? You know, I know there's a lot of people talking about shame today, but I think to me, the main reason that we need to deal with our shame is that's the best thing that we can do to help our healing, mm-hmm, is to be able to talk about it with other people that are trusted sources that you feel will keep your confidence until you're ready to share something. I think that's a really important thing. I did not tell anyone for almost 20 years besides a bishop. He didn't want me to talk to my parents about it, so I didn't tell my parents. My sisters, I didn't talk to them about it. I come from a fairly open family, and I think that just perpetuated the shame in me is that it's really too shameful to even tell those people that you're very close to and that will love you and help you. I really think that's kind of the basis of the problem, is that we have to get it out there and talk about it with people that we trust.
Yeah, for sure.
So can I ask, I feel like I have a similar experience in that, like not talking to my family and especially to my sisters who I know would be supportive. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to do that. Do you think there was fear also that they would encourage you to leave him? Or do you think it was all just in the shame of how could you stay with him for so long through this?
You know, it's hard to pinpoint it exactly, Naomi. One of the things that I grew up with was there's very few reasons for divorce being justifiable, that you did everything to hold your marriage together. And so that was one of the things that was going on behind the scenes. Plus, I was raised in an environment where your spouse was first, and your other family members were second. If your spouse asks you to do something, that's more important than somebody else asking you to do something. You know, he is the most important person that you need to keep his confidences and his trust. And so when I first found out that it had reappeared, I said, please, let's go tell our parents. I know they'll pray for us. And he was adamant, no, you are not to tell anyone. And so I did that out of respect for him. Knowing now what I know, there's no way I would ever do that again. I would find somebody within the first month or so of learning that I could talk to about this, and just maybe even expanding the people that I tell, you know. So maybe starting with your parents, you tell, and then as time goes by, you tell a trusted friend. I think that only helps us get rid of the shame. But it is tricky in some families, mm-hmm. when you've been raised in a certain culture and a certain perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really glad you shared that, how you would do things differently.
Yeah.
Because I think there are things that we would all do differently, of course. Right. After I found out about my husband's secret life, that is one thing moving forward, was I was not going to be silent about this. Yeah. So yeah. He was going to have to deal with the shame of it all. I wanted to be authentic with my own experiences and not hide my pain, yeah. from my mother and my sisters and my family. Talked about one of the women in your book feeling confined to not talk about her experience, while other people who are sick and going through cancer treatments can openly talk about their experience. I have told him that if you want to live with me, if I have a prompting to be able to share how the infinite atonement of Jesus Christ has blessed my life and it connects with this experience, like, I'm going to be open with it. I'm not going to share details. It's part of my story, and I get to share my story. So you're going to have to deal with it. And yeah. he seems to be pretty okay with that right now, but we'll see.
I think you bring up a really good point that people have to decide what they're comfortable sharing and with whom and in what situations.
Yeah.
And we're all different, you know. And I think your fact of saying he's going to have to get used to this if he's going to live with me, I never felt strong enough to say that I get to tell who I want to tell, and tough luck to you. I'm not going to go shout it on the rooftops, but I am going to tell people, which I wish I would have done as soon as I found out, rather than live silently with it for 20 years.
Such a painful place to be, to live in silence.
Yeah.
Silencing a woman's voice to me is torture. It feels like torture anyway.
And in my own experience, I think it leads to all kinds of health problems that people don't need to live with. If I'd been more open about it earlier on, maybe I wouldn't have one of the health. In fact, that's what the doctors tell me, is you wouldn't have that had you not kept it bottled in.
Yeah, there's so many health connections as well to keeping it bottled in.
I'm sure that you saw shame show up in the women that you interviewed in the book. So what are some ways that you have seen, and maybe the ways that you have worked to overcome those shame pieces? Like, what allowed you to overcome the shame of talking to your family, of reaching out and starting to get support outside of just your bishop?
Okay. That's a really great question. And I do want to kind of say something in response to what you said about the women in the book. When I would tell people about the women I was interviewing, I would say, these are women that have dealt with it and that have tried to overcome the shame. So these aren't people necessarily that, you know, are still maybe in the trenches where they're not comfortable telling anyone. Because I think a lot of women would never have been able to open up to me as much as they did in the interviews had they still been in that shameful place.
Right.
So from my own perspective, the way that I overcame shame is by telling other people. I started with my mother, which I felt, you know, I could always tell my mother anything, and I would have told her earlier had not it been for his request. But then I remember writing a letter to one of my friends who had told me about a brother-in-law that had had problems with pornography. And so I wrote a letter to her and told her. And then I talked with my sisters. I think it's an iterative process where the shame doesn't go away all at once. But for my own shame, it got better each time I told somebody that I trusted. That's the first thing I would tell women to do if they just found out. Don't carry this burden by yourself. The bishop's going to keep your confidence, but maybe tell the Relief Society president if you know she'll keep your confidence. Maybe tell your best friend if you know she will keep your confidence. And somebody keeping confidence is not because it's a shameful thing. In my mind, it's because, you know, you can only tell your story. Mm-hmm. People won't know what your husband's story is because he hasn't talked to them. So I think telling your own story is important. And I think that's the best way to get out of shame is just by talking about it with people that you trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I remember that first time when I told somebody, it was somebody I didn't even know. It was somebody I was talking with over the phone. And I had no idea who this person was. And just as soon as I started talking, she shared her story first, and then she asked me if I wanted to share mine. And I remember the visceral weight that was lifted off of me. I mean, it was truly a very visceral experience, like physical experience.
Yeah.
But it was scary. Like when I think about it, right. It was like I was going into the dungeon with a dragon kind of thing. I mean, like, and fighting these feelings of not sharing.
Right. Right. And I think the longer you've lived with it and not shared about it, maybe the more difficult that is to share. I think there's enough research and enough things written out there now that a lot of people today, when they find out about their husband's pornography problems, there's enough information out there that says share it with trusted other individuals. I didn't know any of that when I first found out. So in this instance, I think knowledge is power. You remember I said at the beginning that I told bishops in many places I've lived that I'd be happy to talk to any woman and that only one woman had called. Well, at first, I don't think she was planning on telling anybody else. You know, I said, over time, you may be able to talk to your mother and your father about it. And I think she thought, there is no way that I'll be able to do that. But within a couple of weeks, she had told her mother. And then, you know, later, shortly thereafter, her father. And I think it does take a lot of courage, and it's a very scary, as you described. It's like you're going in to bear kind of the deepest thing in your soul when you tell somebody.
Yeah, I agree. I remember telling my sisters for the first time, I had already started getting help at that point, but it was at the point that My marriage was definitely on really rocky ground. And it was time for me to separate and time for me to move. And that was kind of the point which I actually wasn't even prepared to tell them, but my spouse started talking to my brother-in-laws. And so I was like, okay, well, you opened the door, so here it goes.
You know? Yeah. And, was that helpful for you?
Oh, it was so helpful. It was so, and I knew that my sisters would be supportive. For me, the shame was who I chose to marry, why I stayed with them, why I kept it a secret for so long.
All of that adds up.
Mm-hmm. There were so many reasons that I just felt like I can't tell anybody, because then they'll be like, why don't you just go, you know? And I didn't want to be told what to do. I think I wanted to come to that decision on my own. I think that's can be sometimes other people's experience too, of keeping it in and not wanting to share, fear of what they're going to say when you're not there, you know, what are their judgments going to be about you and your situation and why you're staying and why you're not going.
Yeah.
But that process of opening up to my sisters and telling them the story and getting that support that I wish I had all along, you know, like this would have been so nice to have this whole time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, and I think the reason, you know, that telling somebody helps surely with the start of your recovery. But for me anyway, I found that my shame kind of entered in to my own personal development in the fact that I stopped feeling like I could be myself. Yeah. I kind of felt like the shame stole my identity.
Yes, yes.
My identity is as a proactive woman, that I'm going to be really intentional and move things forward. And that was lost as a result of my shame. And that takes a little while for things to come back. Mm-hmm. But to me, that's one of the saddest pieces of this for a lot of people, is that the shame kind of eats away at their own identity. They don't stay true to who they are or who they have been in the past, but the shame has kind of morphed their own identity because they're so tied to what their husband is doing.
It's like stunts the growth.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah. And that just makes me really sad, not only for myself, but for other women that, you know, you kind of feel like you're walking on eggshells all the time.
Yes.
And that feeds into the shame, but it also kind of feeds into the, okay, my life has to be what he says he's doing in his life, rather than I'm going to be proactive about this. Mm-hmm. And I think once you can kind of get rid of that shame and start to talk to people about it, hopefully who you are comes back over time.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that's something that I hadn't really connected to the shame, but you're absolutely right.
So one of the things one of my sisters said to me when she first found it, she said, how on earth did this happen to you? You speak your mind, you're out there. How did this happen to you? That question made me realize, well, it happened to me because the shame over time allowed who I was to change. I became much more passive and much more deferential towards him and what he wanted to keep, you know, the marriage going.
Keep the peace.
Yeah. And I think most of the women that I interviewed felt the same way, that while there were certain parts of who they were that stayed, there were many parts that they felt like they had to change or make different so that they could live in the marriage and with all the shame that was going on.
Mm-hmm. And to me, that also feels a lot like emotional abuse, in that you're not allowed to have these feelings about this. Especially that, like you described, that walking on eggshells, trying to be so ever so careful about what you do. You don't want to do anything that might cause him shame or cause him to react or to be triggered to act out, or, you know, any number of things. And so there's certainly a level of emotional abuse that ties into that, not being able to speak up and not being able to hold your own like you would have in the past.
Yeah,
it is sad and quite depressing, really, you know, to look back and mm-hmm. see, at least for myself, to look back and see how slow my development was through those years. And I'm in a place of where I've been separated for 4 years, and I can see how much I've grown just in 4 years, and how much more brave I am in speaking out and speaking up than I ever have been, you know, in the past. And just having that freedom to be able to do that is such a difference. And at the same time, I still hesitate to open up, just still being in this place that I'm at. So,
right. Yeah. It's hard. I think the other piece that plays into the shame is the sexuality piece. A lot of times when we're taught about sex or when we talk about sex, it is kind of a shameful, because this involves sex. I think it adds an extra layer that maybe a shame about being an alcoholic doesn't necessarily bring. And I think for a lot of women, because it does have those sexual overtones, they're very hesitant to be as open about it initially, but also more in depth, like, this is how it impacted our sex life. You know, this mm-hmm. is what it happened. You probably didn't know what was going on for me, but this is what I felt like was going on. And because that's often so personal and private, a lot of those feelings just get shoved down. Most married couples who don't have pornography or another addiction in their marriage, it's a very different experience than those who know they're having sex with someone who is finishing off a fantasy that they weren't even a part of, but that started online somewhere and that has just continued in his mind. And I think that makes the shame even worse. It did for me anyway. And I think for a lot of the women I interviewed, that how do you talk about something so private and yet so important to your marriage without having this come in?
Yeah.
I think as a people, we typically don't talk about sex in the way of how it impacts your intimacy and your feelings close to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. All the more reason to start teaching the next generation about what healthy sexuality looks like, so that they can detect, you know, when a relationship is not healthy.
Right.
If you didn't know kind of what a healthy sexual relationship would be like, that it is very relational, and when you bring porn into the relationship, it completely disrupts that whole sexual experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think for that reason, a lot of women that we interviewed were in therapy. But I think a sex therapist can often be very helpful in dealing with some of those, if you decide to stay in the marriage and dealing with some of those feelings of sexuality that you haven't been able to talk about what you need. And most people need to feel, especially women, need to feel like there's trust there, that it's a safe place. And if you've been used to having sex when it didn't feel safe, that's kind of changed some things in you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Naomi can very much relate.
It's going to take a lot of time to work through, for sure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tell us how you came in contact with these women that you interviewed. What was kind of your process?
Well, all I did was put in an ad in a couple of places. You know, being in academia, you do research and you get participants in a different variety of ways, depending upon the participants that you're wanting to work with. And all we did was put an advertisement for the research in a couple of therapists' offices and on like a chat board or a discussion board. And they contacted us. I only wanted to interview women that were members of the church. And we even had some women just beg us, please, 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 I want to participate in this. But it was really wonderful that we were able to get women at different stages of life. So we had a newlywed, like within a year, and then we had somebody that had been married for over 30 years. And let me tell you, if you've lived with this for 30 years in a marriage, it's a hard, hard thing. They are not very happy. And I completely understand why. But by the end of 30 years of living with it, it's not a fun thing for them.
Yeah. I lived with it for 28 years, but I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
and that's a very different experience too.
Well, and we were able to get people from different areas of the country at the time. Most of the advertisement we had done, I was at Southern Utah University, which is in Southern Utah. And so the flyers, ads about this research mostly were in that area, but we got people from all over the U.S. Mm-hmm. That to me was really important as well. There's something many people who haven't done qualitative research, it's very different than doing like survey research. And one of the things you look for in doing interviews is once you start to hear similar things, similar trends, similar patterns, they call it you've reached saturation, which means, okay, you could interview another 20 people, but you're still going to hear the same thing. It was really clear when we had reached that, even though these women were all so different, you know, a lot of it was the overcoming of the shame, how they navigated this feeling that they didn't have any intimacy in their marriage. They had lost who they were. They didn't have that connection that it had started to impact their spirituality. They felt angry at God or priesthood leaders. Mm-hmm. You heard this across most of the women we interviewed. And that to me said, okay, we're finished in the need to do more interviews, even though they may want, you know, other women may want to talk to us. We're going to hear the same thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that's usually when qualitative researchers know we can be finished here. We've heard the extent of what we're going to hear.
Yeah. And I do feel like the stories in your book encapsulate what I have heard in my recovery communities.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything in the book that I haven't heard already.
Yeah.
That it just seems to be very similar patterns and experiences that the women going through.
Yeah. And it was such an honor to be able to interview these women, you know, for them to be able to share their stories. Wow. It just felt so, they trusted us. It felt so just, it was just such an effort of love that they were extending by sharing their stories because they are so personal. And things that happen are so personal. And I was just always so grateful for women being able to be open with us and share the things that are like the closest to their heart that oftentimes many other people don't know. And how wonderful that was to be able to share that.
Yeah. And even for them, likely there is an element of healing, a continued healing that happens too. So it's like this reciprocal relationship.
Right. It was always interesting to me too. You know, like if I were to say to either of you, I'd like to interview you, you would gather your thoughts and organize them. And that's what we saw. Women had just kind of this ability to tell us how they found out, what they did to their, you know, if they felt like they had experienced betrayal trauma, what that had done to them and their families and how they tried to deal with it. I took that as the highest form of compliment, that they would think ahead of time of how to organize their experience in order to tell us what they were feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oftentimes when I'm feeling something emotionally intensely, I kind of lose track of where I am. Mm-hmm. But it was clear that they had tried to do all they could to kind of organize their thoughts and tell us them in a way that was meaningful for them. Do you have a favorite story, Janine?
That caught me off guard.
I'm sorry.
Got a lot of underlining. A number of years ago when I was reading the book, I think at the time for me, it was really important to be validated with their experiences with ecclesiastical leaders. Mm-hmm. I think I was resonating with that because I was so distraught about how this was handled in the church. I was just so distraught. Like, it really rocked my foundation, not my relationship with God so much, but that these men who have a porn problem are in our leadership. And it's not just my husband. It is all across the board. Yeah. How does this work? The power of the priesthood can't exist on principles of unrighteousness. It was like just this big awakening that I have had to come to terms with. Feeling validated in that way and knowing that I wasn't the only one who had that experience, that there were many other women who have had that experience, is very validating. It doesn't make the process of reconciling that any easier, but at least I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
When I hear your story, you were very lucky to have a bishop that helped you kind of work through that, because that was not my case at all. Yeah. And that's not the experience of many other women in the church. No. And I think to navigate that now, I would do that so differently. Definitely do that so much differently.
Yeah.
And I would definitely be having a voice, let me tell you that. But at the time, my experience was like, this is completely overwhelming. Yeah. Like, this is a secret I did not know about. How could I not know about this? I mean, I was just dealing with a flood of emotions. And I didn't really want to be viewed as some lunatic woman in the bishop's office. And that's exactly how I think I would have reacted had I let my emotions loose in the office. Yeah. And I was really holding back and restraining my emotions in there because I did not want to be perceived that way. And now, boy, I just would.
You'd let it loose.
I would have a lot of choice words to say. And be okay with saying it. I wouldn't be ashamed handling it the way I needed to handle it. And had I known things were going to work out the way they did, boy, I would have definitely done things very different. Not that that would have changed the outcome in any way, but I would have felt like I had at least expressed what I needed to express.
Right. Yeah, I think, first of all, you're right. I was very lucky. You know, this bishop that I mentioned, he was a convert and his sister had problems with alcohol. And it sounds like he and his siblings did this kind of retreat where they learned about addictions. And that kind of training was invaluable as he guided me through that. He knew what, you know, kind of what to press, and he knew kind of what callings I was needing, and it was very helpful for me. And I do realize that was a very much unique and an anomaly. and it makes me really sad for women. And that's why another reason that I wrote in the introduction that this can be very helpful for bishops who look at a woman and they don't completely understand everything that's going on behind the scenes and the shame that she's feeling and how he might be adding to that shame, you know? And so I always am really happy when bishops have read it and they find it moving themselves and helpful for them. But we've got a lot of bishops to train, right?
Yes, and more to come. I feel like there's something that can be improved upon in that department for sure.
Yeah.
That's another topic.
Yeah. But it's a topic associated with shame, you know, because you have to go in, and sometimes the bishop will let you be part of his interview. Sometimes it's like, no, that's, you know, you're not going to be part of it. I'm not going to tell you anything about how he's doing, which I think some bishops, other bishops feel like if you're married, you deserve to know what's going on with this because it impacts you. So there's just lots of shame associated, even from when you're a youth, you know, talking about oh, I need to go see the bishop, you know, any kind of sin we associate that with. It's really unfortunate to me that that seeing the bishop is associated always with sin.
And
this is different than sin.
And I think sometimes, at least where I get hung up, is when a bishop tries to be a counselor and they're not trained to be, because that's where I feel like more damage is done, is when they're doling out advice that is damaging, that is not their place to dole out. Like, I understand that they want to be helpful and they want, you know, but that's where I feel like there needs to be some training in that. It's not your job to fix their marriage. It's not your job to tell them what they need to do to fix their marriage. Like, that's not your responsibility in this process. Like, and so that's where we need a lot more, training.
Or diagnose them. This is what my bishop did. Oh yeah, he's not addicted.
It's really common. Well, and you know, Naomi, to go along with what you're saying about they don't know, a lot of times I think you remember reading in the book, women are told that they need to change something to fix this. And women need to know, okay, this is not your responsibility. This is them, and it has a huge impact on you, but this is their behavior. You don't need to be more sexy, or you don't need to like put makeup on every day. All those kinds of things are so counterproductive to helpful healing and getting over, like, I have some role in his behavior. So I do feel badly for women that have heard those things from their
Like, I always want to put it out there, like, no amount of sex, no amount of makeup, no amount of weight, no amount of anything will change the fact that he is addicted. Like, the change has to come from him and him alone.
And I think when you said, Janine, that the bishop diagnosed that he wasn't an addict, I think that's a really hard thing navigate as well, is, and that's why you need a professional. Are they truly addicted, or, you know, is it just something they enjoy and they could stop doing? So he never would frequently go in and see the bishop about it. He was secret from the bishop.
Not when we were married. He did when he before he went on a mission. He did, but. Well, Carmel, thank you for joining us. We know our time's up, and we really appreciate you writing the book and then sharing these women's stories with us. They are so relatable. And if you haven't read the book, we would really encourage you to grab a copy. It's was very helpful to me. And thank you so much in engaging with us in this conversation on shame. We know that shame drives us to isolation, and we can be stuck in shame for many, many years, as you as you shared with us. And so, because there's fear of judgment of others, there's fear of what our husbands will do. Often we blame ourselves. Naomi mentioned there's no amount of sex, there's no amount of beauty that changes this. It's all about him and his inability to deal with his life and his emotions. And I appreciate the things that you have shared with us on what has been helpful for you to get out of shame. Naomi and I both are yes. Definitely. We agree that sharing your story is really important.
The first step.
Yep, it is a good first step. So is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Just, I'm thankful for you guys to talk about this. And I do think hearing other women's stories can make your own, living with your own story, less painful. There's still going to be pain there, but realizing there's other women out there that have lived through this and that have gone through different things, I think it's very helpful.
Yeah, we agree.
Thank you for having me on.
Yes, thank you so much for being here.
Want to join a free online therapist-led group with Worth? Head on over to healingwithworth.org to enroll.